What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on our podcast, the wealth tax debate heard round the Twitter. Senator Elizabeth Warren has been calling for billionaires, like investor Leon Cooperman, to pay their fair share.
All we're saying is that when you make it big, and I mean really big, I mean the top one-tenth of 1%, pitch in a little more.
And today, Leon Cooperman is telling his side of the tax story.
I do believe in the progressive income tax structure. I do believe rich people should pay more, okay? The wealth tax makes no sense to me for lots of reasons.
Twitter earnings beat expectations but missed on user growth. CFO Ned Segal on getting people to tweet.
As economies open all around the world, our product improvements are designed to help people continue to find what they're looking for.
Those stories, plus Amazon, the EU investigating Apple, and a vitamin deal that brings people together.
I'm happy that we share.
We share a lot of things, Joe.
We do.
It's Friday, April 30th, 2021. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. More importantly, welcome to Friday. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Andrew?
Thanks, Becky. Appreciate it. It's very good to see everybody. Let's talk about these record Amazon results, because they were blowout numbers across the board. Profit more than tripling in that first quarter. You had revenue soaring 44% to $108 billion. Company expecting momentum to continue. It's offering guidance that continued to blow out people's expectations. The forecast now, current quarter sales between $110 and $116 billion. That stock moving higher in the pre-market. Joining us right now to discuss the blockbuster results at Amazon and across the rest of the tech sector is Henry Blodgett. He's the CEO and co-founder of Insider Inc. Henry, it's great to see you. We should also mention that Jeff Bezos, many, many years ago, invested early in Business Insider. Of course, you sold that business, but nonetheless, what did you make of this quarter? It was a blowout.
I think it's sustainable. I do think it would be unrealistic to think that when all the stimulus runs out and the economy gets fully back to normal, we won't see some adjustment at Amazon and other companies. I would think that would be reasonable to think.
You just said when the economy gets back to normal, but and when the stimulus runs out. But depending on what you think is about to happen in Washington, we may have stimulus in some regard for many years to come.
We may, but we'll also probably hit a peak of it within the next 6 months or so. And then the question is, what happens on the other side? I mean, things are just extraordinarily strong now, certainly in advertising. We saw this with tech. Amazon's benefiting from that, too. There's still an enormous amount of consumer spending that's going into Amazon and others. But I do think that at some point we're going to reach a peak of that stimulus. And then we're going to gradually go back to the organic economic growth. And I think that what we often see is that the stock market is peaking around the time that you are just at that absolute peak of enthusiasm and things couldn't be any better. And that's the time to sort of wonder and say, OK, where are we going from here?
I don't know if you noticed, but one of the numbers that popped out to me yesterday was the CapEx number, how much money this company spends to actually build in a given year. They spent $50 billion last year. This is on things like infrastructure, data centers, and the like. It was up 80%, and they seem to suggest this was going to continue. And, you know, we're going to be seeing Warren Buffett this weekend talk about, you know, his company. But he has often talked about defensive moats. That seems to me to be the best defensive moat you could ever get if you could spend this kind of money, because there's virtually no other company in America that's going to be able to build that kind of infrastructure.
No, it's exactly right. And I think if you step back from Amazon and really look at it on a multi-year or even multi-decade basis, what the company has done again and again is foregone current quarter and current year earnings for long-term investment. And they got so much crap for that for so many years, and it is now continuing to pay off in spades. And I think one of the things that a lot of other companies, I hope, in the U.S. can take away from that is that it's okay to do that. That, in fact, that's what you right. should be teaching your shareholders that you should do to create long-term value, because, boy, is it paying off for Amazon.
Which then raises the question about some of the other high flyers. So Shopify, which has had an extraordinary run, especially during this pandemic, both in the markets and in the real economy. We heard earlier that eBay is suggesting, actually in part because of expectations around stimulus coming off, that they're expecting sales to slow.
So what I was talking about earlier, in other words, that we're at this peak and then things will fade. Yes. I mean, look, across the tech sector, we've talked about this a lot. There's just such extraordinary enthusiasm. You're seeing pockets of froth, however you want to describe it, and NFTs and the cryptocurrencies and so forth. These things, Andrew, these remind me a lot of the late 1990s. We're seeing it. And I think often when we get in this, you never know how long it's going to last. And anybody who says they know is not being honest with themselves. But at some point, usually these market conditions change. And I think at some point we'll see that fundamentally, too. But right now, across certainly the big tech names that we reported, there's no other way to describe the results than staggering. I mean, to see companies right. this size growing at this speed, it's just we have not seen this before.
Henry Blodgett, always good to see you. Have a great weekend.
Great to see you all.
Thanks.
Thank you.
The EU, European Union, has formally brought some charges against Apple related to the fees it charges in its App Store. Regulators say they're concerned about the mandatory use of Apple's in-app purchase system, which charges merchants a 30% fee. Seems reasonable. And they say Apple's rules limit the ability of app developers to steer users toward alternative methods of payment. I didn't know anything costs 30% anymore. Becky, that's... If you're generous with a tip, it's like 25 to 30% if you're generous. Right?
Yeah, but if you're hosting it, 30%. If it's your platform, the only way you're getting through. I don't know what stocking fees are on some grocery stores too.
You've got to charge a fair amount. We got to do everything.
So what's
we got to do everything.
Joe?
We got to do everything fairly
what's
now.
What's fair?
That's
what's fair?
The question. Doesn't matter.
That's the definition
just say
of fair.
It.
Exactly.
Just keep saying it. Say it over and over and
sounds
over
good.
And over. Gotta be fair. Gotta be fair. Gotta be. Who's going to disagree? It's gotta be fair.
Nestle, the world's biggest packaged food company, is buying Nature's Bounty and other vitamin brands for about $5.8 billion. The move will help Nestle expand its health and nutrition business. The Bountiful Company, owned by private equity firm KKR, will hold on to its sports and active nutrition business. But I've been taking those vitamins for years. That's my Nature's Bounty is my brand. Pick it up at CVS all the time.
I would.
And they have sleep
gummies or
melatonin. I don't know. Oh no, I just like a vitamin C B. It was my Nature's Bounty. I have some in the in the bathroom.
I feel like you're leading me to tell you that I take Centrum Silver. I think you're leading me to tell you that. And it's a heck of a vitamin. And it's not just
for
people.
Can I tell you something?
Yeah.
I want to tell you something.
Yeah.
I also take Centrum Silver, but I will tell you, and you say, why Centrum Silver now, given that I'm such a young man just after my bar mitzvah here?
Well, so am
but,
I. So am I. But well, I still
as
take
you
it.
Are,
so
as you
the,
are.
We're the same there.
If you read the magazines, which I do, they say that Centrum Silver is actually better to take, no matter what your age, than regular Centrum for reasons that I don't really remember anymore. But, on those days
there.
When you used to go to the gym and read, like, Men's Health magazine and try to get the exercise through osmosis just by reading it, they would tell you about Centrum Silver. So there's a little
I'm happy
news you can
that
use.
We both do, that we share that. I'm happy that
we share a lot of things, Joe.
We do. I'm happy we share the Centrum Silver thing. It's awesome.
Coming up, we heard this from Senator Elizabeth Warren earlier this week.
Let's start by asking Leon Cooperman just to pay 3 cents, since he's a billionaire, in a wealth tax. Make that contribution.
And Leon Cooperman joins us next.
I'm a capitalist by nature, but I'm a capitalist with a heart. I'm giving away all my money, but I want to give it away. I don't want the government to give it away.
Squawk Pod is back after this.
Hello, I'm Laura Castleton, U.S. Head of Portfolio Construction and Strategy at Janus Henderson Investors. Is a brighter future possible? At Janus Henderson, we think it is. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. We know that this means our thinking and our investments are helping to shape millions of brighter futures for the next 90 years and beyond. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
This is Squawk Pod from CNBC with Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Here's Becky.
Legendary investor and philanthropist Lee Cooperman, the chairman and CEO of the Omega Family Office. He's been in a high-profile battle for a while with Senator Elizabeth Warren over issues of lots of things, including tax policy. In fact, here's what the senator told us on Squawk Box earlier this week.
Everyone who built a successful business here in America did it using a workforce that all of us paid to educate, did it getting their goods to market on roads and bridges that all of us helped to pay to build, did it protected by police and firefighters that all of us helped pay their salaries. And all we're saying is that when you make it big, and I mean really big, I mean the top 0.1%, pitch in a little more.
Lee, that was Elizabeth Warren earlier this week, and I know you've had your back and forth with her in the past. What do you have to say just about what she's saying right now about taxes and about what she said about you?
Well, I don't know what she said about me personally. I'll defer the entire blame on this whole interchange on CNBC. And I say that with a big smile on my face. I was a guest speaker at one of your conferences a couple of years ago, and my presentation had nothing to do with politics. It was made at a time when she was running strongly as a candidate. And the moderator of my panel asked me, what would the market do if Elizabeth Warren was elected president? And I said, we'd go down 20%. Probably too optimistic.
There is unquestionably a shift to the left in this country. They won't open the stock market if Elizabeth Warren is the next president. I take to quoting Winston Churchill, I'm committed to capitalism with all its flaws.
The next day, not knowing anything about me, she tweets, Leon, I'm only looking for 2%. Give others a shot at the American dream. And this is what really aggravated me in the end. Okay, I decided to take a leaf out of Michelle Obama's book, and I basically wrote her a very good letter. In fact, the letter was so good that I got a call from a former president of Harvard University, a very distinguished, brilliant economist who happens to be on the Democratic side.
Larry Summers?
Excuse me?
Larry Summers, I'm guessing.
Yeah, good guess. You know, and he said, if you submitted that paper, a letter as a paper in my class, I'd give you an A+. Not an A+. So what does she do in response to my letter? The next day she tweets, insider trader, which she libeled me. I won the case, basically, and own stock in Navient. Thank God I did, because the stock has doubled. She has a thing about student loan companies, and all her allegations have been not found to be accurate. So she proved to me she was a politician in the worst sense of the word. It's a soundbite. Now, let me just say this. I do believe in the progressive income tax structure. I do believe rich people should pay more. Okay, the wealth tax makes no sense to me for lots of reasons. Okay, in all the countries it's been introduced, I think 14 out of 17, it's been eliminated. Okay, and there's so many better ways of going about what she's looking to accomplish. Raise the marginal tax rate to a higher level. Eliminate loopholes. If you go back into your news recall, your archives, 7 years ago on your program, I said they should eliminate the carried interest. It's a loophole. We should eliminate the Department of Education. We don't need a $100 billion cabinet to tell the states how to educate their children. Segregation is over. Okay, we should eliminate the tax code item 1031, which enables real estate people to roll forward indefinitely capital gains, defer the taxes. There's a lot of things we could do. We don't need a wealth tax. It's going to be impossible to supervise. It's going to lead to very unnatural acts, and it hasn't worked. And by the way, I'm not too worried about it, because I think in the end it's probably unconstitutional. But she just proved to me to be a politician in the worst sense of the word. I don't know her. I don't vote in Massachusetts, but I think she's very wrong-minded. And I would have hoped that she would have come back to my letter in a rational, intelligent response to engage at a higher level, because we do have problems in the country. You know, I'm a capitalist by nature, but I'm a capitalist with a heart. I'm giving away all my money, but I want to give it away. I don't want the government to give it away. I think as a nation, we have to coalesce around the question, what should the max and tax rate be on wealthy people? Because that will define the revenue yield to the U.S. government. And the government has to size themselves to that revenue yield. Now, a guy that you and I are both very fond of, Warren Buffett, I called him 7 or 8 years ago, and, you know, he didn't say his response was confidential, but I asked Warren, I said, you talk about wealthy people pay more in taxes. I agree with that. What do you got in mind? And his response at that time, it may be different today. I don't know. You'll probably speak to him before I do. He said that if you make $1 million a year, 35%. If you make $5 million a year, 40%. Well, guess what? Between state and local government taxes, if you live in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, California, you're into the mid-50s. And this is very counterproductive.
That's the point, Lee. That and we had Frank Luntz on, who has polled people, I don't know if everyone really realizes that 50% is what average wealthy people pay over 50, probably with state. And we hear about the ultra rich, and they've accrued the ultra rich money, whether it was paying ordinary income as they were making it or whether they inherited it and maybe there was step up, so they didn't pay it there. But the way they get to a 7% tax rate is because, you know, that it's existing capital. And if you actually did talk to people about what they think is fair, Frank Luntz said they think a third is fair.
What percentage should that top 1%, what percent should corporations pay? When you actually ask the American people these questions, they would say that no American should pay more than one third of their income, not a half, one third of their income. That would be the midpoint in what is fair share. But we know that the wealthy pay much more than that.
Even if you go to 50%, I think 50% is fair, but a lot of these proposals, you're going to go up well above 50. So I don't know whether that, if you poll people with that, I'm not sure they should think. Maybe they do. Maybe if you make $500 million or have that much, maybe you should have an 80% marginal tax rate.
You and I are on the same side of things. How do you get to be very wealthy? You develop a product or service that the world wants. Is the world better off or worse off because of Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, Bernie Marcus, Ken Langone? I think the world is definitely better off because
of people. What about their kids that inherited?
We should make sure that everybody pays taxes. Okay, and I quote Thomas Sowell, who's a man of color, a conservative economist, who said, since this is an era when most people are concerned about fairness and social justice, what is your fair share of what someone else has worked for? Now, I've said in this program before, I'm willing to work 6 months a year for the government and 6 months for myself. That seems reasonable to me. Okay, beyond that, it becomes confiscatory. And you wind up with actions that are counterproductive. The draining of population in New York and New Jersey and California, people moving, you know, to other regions, low tax regions. People are smart. They're not stupid.
Hey, Lee, I have a question about philanthropy, and you've been very generous over the years, and your circumstance may actually be different than some of the people that I'm thinking of, because you're in the hedge fund business, and therefore oftentimes you sell stock, and therefore when you're giving, I think, some of the money that you've given away, I think you've given it in cash, meaning you've paid the taxes on stock that's been sold prior. But a lot of charity, especially among the billionaire set, is given in the context of shares, which effectively have never been taxed. So, and I'm not picking on Warren Buffett or Bill Gates or anybody else who's done wondrous things for this country, but oftentimes that money is not taxed, meaning they've built a remarkable fortune and then they've been able to give that money away. But that the government and other taxpayers who don't obviously have this benefit to be able to choose where to send their money don't have that. How do you think about that issue?
Well, the tax code was designed to encourage philanthropy. So to the extent that you're giving away pre-tax dollars that are appreciated, it reduces your cost. But, you know, we're not talking about 90 or 100% tax rates. We're talking about 37.6% tax rate. So you're giving away serious money. Now, everybody has their own view. I determined many, many years ago, there's only four things you could do with money. The first thing you could do with money is you could, pleasure yourself by planes, art, homes, stuff like that. My wife and I, we happen to have a view that material possessions brings with it aggravation. So we're less is more. I just bought a new car the other day, and the car I traded in was a 2002 Lexus. I kept the car for 20 years. You know, I bought a Hyundai. You know, I'm not a collector of things. Second thing you do, it might give it to your kids. But if you have a lot of money, giving all your money to your kids is a mistake because you deprive them of self-achievement. The third thing you do with your money is give it to the government. But only a fool gives the government money more than they're entitled to. You pay your taxes as a good citizen, and the rest you keep. And the fourth thing you do with money, which is what I'm principally involved with now, is recycle it back in society and try to make the world a better place. And that's kind of my commitment. So I'm far from the most generous guy. I wish I had more money to give away. I'm giving away 100% of my money. I told that to Warren Buffett 9 years ago when he solicited me. I told him the giving pledge was a great idea. It wasn't original. In 1900, Andrew Carnegie said, he who dies rich dies disgraced. In 1930, Sir Winston Churchill said, you make a living by what you get, you make a life by what you give. When President Kennedy was inaugurated president of the country in 1961, he said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And then I told Warren that I'm Jewish, and they say in the Talmud, you measure man not by what he has, but what he gives. And, you know, I get a great deal of enjoyment. Recently, I gave $50 million to create the Koopman College Scholars. I pay the college tuition for 1,000 children of color that deserve a break, largely in Newark, and I have other things I'm doing. And I get my family and I get great pleasure out of that. If you're talking about 90% tax rates, that's one thing. But, you know, people are giving away real money, but they're giving away money that's that they don't use. And, you know, another expression is, you know, shrouds don't have pockets. You can't take it with you. So, you know, I want to make a difference.
I was going to ask you the comments about stock buybacks, that they're just purely used to boost the share price so that the CEOs can enrich themselves, that the companies exist to pay lobbyists to exploit loopholes so that they can keep taxes.
Hey, Senator, it's Becky. Let me ask you about share buybacks. This is something I've also heard you talk about recently, where you said share buybacks is market manipulation. I mean, share buybacks in a lot of ways, if you're just thinking of it as a partnership. And I know that, you know, legally you've looked through all of these things. You're a professor on these issues. But if you want to buy out your partners, your partner wants out, you buy back the shares. I mean, that doesn't sound to me like market manipulation. It just sounds like the way businesses work.
No, if you want to buy your partner shares and you want to hold your partner shares, that's fine. But that's not what share buybacks
that's
are.
That's what a company
share
is doing.
Buybacks,
buy back.
No, well, share buybacks are going into the market and pumping up the price of your shares by sucking back in, by using your own cash not to invest in business. Look, I'm not the one who started on the idea that this was market manipulation. This was the view of the SEC back in the 1980s. And that was, there is no reason for a company to move into the market and buy anonymously thousands of its own shares for any reason other than to raise the price of its shares. And why do they want to raise the price of their shares? Because executive compensation is tagged to that price.
These are companies that have hired how many people? They've enriched shareholders, which is not a bad thing if it's a $2 trillion market cap. We don't see it happening in the rest of the world, this vibrant technology sector and all the wonderful things that come from it. Is it harmful to have politicians like Elizabeth Warren demagoguing these issues with really stuff that's not true? It's basically not true, but it has an effect. And people believe it when they hear it. And they think that, you know, they're virtuous by taking her side of things on these things that are being gaslit. Does it have a long term a negative effect, do you think? Or do people just overlook it and say they're
absolutely, if it goes that way. Listen, we have a very divided country. I said in your program, you know, I probably should keep it confidential. I voted for Biden. I voted for Biden because I thought we needed a change. Donald Trump had decent economic ideas, but his values were not my values. So I voted for Biden, okay? But I'm a capitalist, and I think that I go along with Will Rogers, the satirist, who said that if politicians delivered on 10% of what they promised, there would be no need for heaven. Both parties are lacking. You know, I was very surprised at how a few Republicans spoke out against Donald Trump when he, you know, with some of his picadillos. Okay, I was very surprised at how few Democrats spoke out about the violence in cities. You know, I've been a registered independent for 25 years. I switched to a Democrat because I'm a great fan of Michael Bloomberg. So when he ran for presidency, I wanted to be able to vote for him. So I changed my registration. I'm going back to independent. Okay. But Elizabeth Warren is into soundbite journalism. I go, you know, soundbite politics. You know, wealth tax sounds good, you know, but it doesn't work. It doesn't make any sense. You know, raise the tax rate on ordinary income. Get rid of the loopholes. You know, I suspect that we have not gotten rid of carried interest, even though it's been talked about for a decade, because a lot of, you know, Schumer doesn't want to support that because his constituency is New York and all these, you know, well-to-do guys that are benefiting from carried interest. We got to do the right thing, you know, and that's it.
It's really great to see you. Happy belated birthday, and we hope we get to talk to you soon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, and good luck, and stay safe and stay healthy.
Next on Squawk Pod, Twitter CFO Ned Siegel on privacy and what content should or shouldn't be removed from the platform.
The only way we can serve the public conversation is to make sure that people hear all sides of a conversation, whether it's around sports or we're on different sides of the political aisle.
And have you voted for Squawk Pod for a People's Voice Award at the Webbies? We are a nominee in the award celebrating the best of the internet. Go to cnbc.com/vote Squawk Pod to be a part of the Webbies.
Support for this program is provided by Chevron. Methane management is a critical part of achieving a lower carbon future. Chevron is taking action to keep methane in the pipe. Their 2028 upstream methane intensity target is set to be 53% below the 2016 baseline. They're committed to evolving facility designs and operating practices. And they've trialed over 13 advanced detection technologies, including drones and satellites. That's energy in progress. Learn more at chevron.com/methane.
You're listening to Squawk Pod from CNBC. Here's Andrew Ross Sorkin.
Shares of Twitter, they are under pressure after the company missed on user growth expectations and provided some lower revenue guidance for the next quarter. Joining us right now, first on CNBC, is Twitter CFO Ned Siegel. And Ned, it's great to see you this morning. Lots of questions for you. You know, it's one of those quarters where you beat on the numbers. And then the question, of course, were the expectations just too high about what the future is going to hold?
Well, thanks for having me, Andrew. Remember, we set bold goals just a couple months ago to double our revenue to $7.5 billion in 2023, to continue to compound our audience to 315 million, so 20% annualized over the last year and the next few years in 2023. And a couple months in, we feel really good about the progress we've made. We grew ads revenue 32%. We grew our audience 20%, which is in line with what we thought we'd do at the beginning of the quarter. So we've made really good progress so far.
How should investors think about this issue of monetizable daily active users, which did not grow at the levels that I think people were hoping for?
Well, we grew over 30 million year over year, 7 million sequentially, and 20% annualized in Q1. And we shared, as we start to lap both COVID-19 and then a year where in the United States, people were very focused on the lead up to and the aftermath of the presidential election for the last year, that as we'd said back in February, we expect Q2, Q3, and Q4 to see low double digit growth with a low point likely in Q2. So there's no change to what we've said before. And as economies open all around the world, our product improvements are designed to help people continue to find what they're looking for, whether it's around sports that they're watching in a stadium as opposed to on their sofa, politics, entertainment, or whatever the topic might be.
Dare I ask, how much do you think this was impacted by Trump?
Well, remember, we added 7 million DAU from Q4. And we mentioned back in February that we added more DAU in the month of January than we did in the average of the last 4 Januaries. There's so much more that happens on Twitter than any one topic. Remember, 80% of the people who use Twitter are outside of the United States. So I just point to all the incredible things that there are to talk about on Twitter, whether it's crypto or entertainment or stocks or other things, and all of those powerful conversations. I think it's easy for us to take a U.S.-centric view of these things. We have to remember all the other incredible conversations that are happening on the service.
I want to talk about all of those in one second, but I do have one question which relates to President Trump, which is, if he was back on the platform, do you think he would still be as big a draw as he used to be?
I don't know how to answer a question like that. I do know that there's still a lot happening on Twitter around politics right now. Today, you can go on and hear conversations around President Biden's tax plan, around the infrastructure plan, around whatever the topics of the day might be. As long as Twitter's been around, people have been talking about politics on our service. The people who are having the conversation might change. The topics of the day continue to evolve. But no matter what, people come to Twitter to share their thoughts, to hear and learn from others.
Right. You know, there have been a lot of folks quite bullish on Twitter, in large part because of the number of acquisitions and new products that you've been introducing and plan to introduce. I still think that there needs to be effectively a bigger funnel, that Twitter needs to be effectively more accessible to more people, that have a greater use case for more people. How do you think about that relative to new products, which just frankly may be more engaging for the current user base?
So every day, we've got a really healthy top of funnel, meaning the number of people who come to Twitter who haven't been on it ever, or who've been on it but haven't been on it for some time, where it's not a part of their daily ritual, it's been remarkably consistent for years. And we actually view the real opportunity as helping more of those people make Twitter part of their daily ritual, where they go to find out what's happening in the world and what people are talking about, to wake up in the morning and come to Twitter to get their news and converse with others around those topics. If we can do a better job of that, we can continue to make progress towards that 315 million goal that we've set for 2023.
There's been lots of debate, as you know, for the past several months about Apple's decision in its new iOS to make it a bit more challenging to track users, at least for advertisers, to do so, giving users the option to opt in effectively. What do you think the impact long term is going to be? I know last night it appeared that you said it was a little too early, but you also suggested that the Apple, getting inside Apple has actually helped you in the past quarter.
Well, we do expect some modest impact from the changes that Apple's made to their operating system, but it's going to be a while for the ecosystem to adjust. Remember, advertisers' objectives haven't changed. The economics of their business haven't changed. Their need to acquire customers haven't changed at all. And so they're going to have to figure out how to realize their objectives when they may have less access through us and others to the information that's most helpful to them in the way that the ecosystem has worked up until now. And that's where our brand advertising may really come into play. You take an example like Pepsi, where they take over Twitter on the Super Bowl. They grew their impressions by 40% year over year because we improved relevance and because we grew our audience relative to last year. If we can help Pepsi get their message out, whether it's around their existing products or around a new version of Mountain Dew, those are great examples of where we can help advertisers deliver, where the device ID, where how people are using other apps on a phone really matter less. And so this may very well level the playing field, where ads platforms may be working with similar signal, as opposed to in the past where people may have had different levels of signal available to them to show relevant ads to people.
Hey, Ned, the other day there was another one of those situations that, you know, that people go crazy on all the cable networks, and it involved Senator Scott, who gave the speech following President Biden. And once again, the allegations are that you selectively will look at content based on whether it's from the left or from the right. And that the woke Twitter mob from the left seems to get a pass a lot of times, where the same type or even less incendiary comments from the right just immediately are blocked. Who's doing it? Is there an inherent bias just with where you're located and who Twitter employs that causes that? Or is it something that's intentional?
Joe, the only way we can serve the public conversation is to make sure that people hear all sides of a conversation, whether it's around sports and we're rooting for different teams, or we're on different sides of the political aisle. We want people to show up in a way where they're respectful of others, where they're not inciting violence off platform, but where they can learn from each other and have a healthy back and forth. And again, whether the topic is investing, sports, or politics, where you can hear from all sides. That's how we help Twitter get to 315 million MDAU by the end of 2023. It's how we help the rest of the world use the service over time as well.
Hey, Ned, you know, we've talked about Bitcoin a little bit together, and I know you're unlike Square, you're not going to be putting Bitcoin on your balance sheet anytime soon. But I'm curious about what the view is inside Twitter about users, maybe prominent users like Elon Musk and others, pushing different cryptocurrencies and like creating memes around some of these things, and also therefore the risk to users who take that advice, if you will, and run with it.
Well, just like any other conversation on our service, we want to make sure that people can trust what they see and feel safe being a part of the conversation. And so this is a pretty dynamic new area that we're watching closely to make sure that we find the right balance between facilitating the conversation and having people be able to trust what they see. It's interesting when you think about crypto and investing, the apps makers around that space, they've grown their spend 10x year over year with Twitter because there's such a rich conversation around these topics on our service, because we've got much better ad formats and we're able to deliver better relevance for those advertisers than we have in the past. I think the conversation is going to be on Twitter for a long time. And I think those advertisers will be able to find their customers on our service for a long time as well.
And then before we go, I want to talk to you about Twitter Spaces. And I'll mention in a second that we're going to do something together on Twitter Spaces. But I'm curious what you think is happening in the social audio world. Clubhouse, of course, appeared to be the pioneer of this space. There was a lot of novelty, a lot of people downloading that app. It has tailed off and I should say almost fallen like a rock if you actually look at some of the numbers for Clubhouse. I know you're just beginning in this space, but what do you see happening?
Well, audio chat rooms where people can go and listen to others or be a part of a conversation are such a natural extension of how people use Twitter. You've got your follower graph, your interest graph, so that we already know what you're interested in. And you've got the people who follow you as well, so they can find you. So with you, me, and Kayvon, right, who leads consumer product, and Jennifer, who leads our people team, are talking in a few minutes on Spaces. People who follow us will be able to find that conversation. We started with text. We moved to images, to video, to audio tweets. This is a real natural extension of it. It'll be fascinating to see how this becomes a part of other services over time. I suspect it will be a part of many services, but the use case will probably be very different for each of them. Maybe you'll do an interview on LinkedIn. On Twitter, you'll come to talk about the NFL draft. You'll come to talk about stocks. You'll come to talk about the new version of a show on Netflix, as you were able to do just last week, or the after party for the Grammys, which we had a few weeks ago as well. I can't wait to see all the different ways that people use this over time on Twitter.
How much do you think social audio is really going to be worth? There are reports that you tried to buy Clubhouse for $4 billion.
Well, Twitter's bought over 20 companies for hundreds of millions of dollars over the last few years. M&A is a core competency for us. The people who've joined Twitter through M&A actually have stated the company, their retention rate is higher than people who come to us regular way. So we're great at attracting people to the company who want to stay with us when we acquire their team, their technology, or a product that they might have. Anytime there's an important opportunity for us to build something, or we're going to think about whether it makes sense to build it ourselves or if we can move faster by doing it through M&A. And so you'll hear our name from time to time around companies that are doing fascinating things that are close to what we do. And we're just going to work hard to strike the right balance between figuring out whether we're going to do it ourselves or whether we can move faster with somebody else's help.
Okay. Ned, appreciate it.
We're done, I guess.
We are.
How much time do I have? None. Got to go now.
Bye-bye.
That's Squawk Pod for today and for the week. On Monday, the Oracle speaks. We'll have the first thoughts in a year on the markets and the economy from Berkshire Hathaway CEO Warren Buffett. Becky Quick will break down all the details from the virtual Berkshire Hathaway annual shareholders meeting this weekend. And for Berkshire followers, you can keep up with all the news about Warren Buffett, Vice Chair Charlie Munger, and the Berkshire portfolio with our weekly Buffett Watch newsletter. It's free. You can sign up to get it in your inbox at BuffettNewsletter.com. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 Eastern. Subscribe to Squawk Pod. Follow us on Twitter at Squawk CNBC. And enjoy your weekend. We'll meet you back here on Monday.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.